Next case for argument, Wisconsin Electric Power v. Union Pacific Railroad, Mr. Pergolesi.
Oh, God.
May it please the Court. This appeal involves two issues. The first, can UP claim force majeure to cancel contract rates in April 2004 based on an event impacting iron ore reloading that occurred in November 2001? And the second, whether the district court erred in dismissing WEPCO's service claims based on an unnecessarily narrow reading of the good faith, the express good faith obligation in the party's transportation agreement. I'd like to...
Could I set a little scenario for you? Suppose the Geneva Steel plant called Union Pacific on November 1st, 2001 and said, we're in bankruptcy, so please cease shipping iron ore as of tomorrow. And the very minute that Union Pacific hung up the phone with Geneva, it sends a fax off to Wisconsin Electric declaring a force majeure event and letting the power company know that as of the next day's shipment, it would be charged the higher non-backhaul rates. There could be no more prompt notification than that, right? I mean, it couldn't be more prompt.
That would be prompt notice.
And yet, Wisconsin Electric would actually have had less time to prepare for the higher rates than it had in that scenario that's actually before us.
Well, yes and no. They would have less time immediately to prepare, but they would have time to alter their long-term plans under the agreement as to where they purchase coal and where they provided for alternate transportation. WEPCO is a regulated utility. The rates are built into their rate structure.
I don't understand how you can complain about their failure to enforce their rights to the hilt.
We believe, Your Honor.
What are you complaining about? Say, oh, well, of course, you have a tremendous obstacle with this no-waiver clause, but you put that aside. You say, well, you know, if somebody discovers a breach or discovers, you know, a condition that entitles him to raise the price, he's got to raise that price. Otherwise, he's hurt you. It's a very, very strange argument.
Your Honor, we're dealing with two...
By the way, if you were to prevail, you know, this reliance stuff, would you give them back or deduct the $7 million?
We do not believe we'd have an obligation to do that.
Well, that's scandalous. I mean, that's ridiculous. Because what you're arguing, you have some nebulous reliance argument that because they didn't notify you and immediately start charging you the higher rate, you were hurt. Even if that were true and actionable and so on, clearly... You derived a benefit from their delay, and you would have to subtract that from any damages you claimed.
Your Honor, the force majeure provision requires three conditions precedent to be able to
Forget about that. Just think about the absurdity of it. You complain that because they failed to enforce their rights to the hilt, you were harmed. But, of course, first you were benefited to the tune of $7 million. And you're saying that you just get any harm you incurred, but you also get this windfall, the $7 million to which you were not entitled by the contract.
Your Honor,
that's an incredible position, I must say.
Your Honor, what we are contending is they have three obligations in order to be able to claim force majeure.
Yeah, but you have to give back the money that you, at the minimum, that you obtain by their failure to invoke their rights at the earliest opportunity.
It's not a matter of invoking rights. It's a matter of fulfilling the obligations. They're supposed to give prompt notice of when the event began.
Look, you have a complete, I think, misunderstanding of the significance and the importance of a no-waiver clause. This is a complex contract, relatively long-term. In such a situation, such a business relationship, it's very important to have a no-waiver clause because you don't want a situation where each party feels it must enforce its rights to the hilt. Because a lot of things, you know, a lot of unanticipated problems arise in the course of a contract like this, and you want the businessmen and the business want to be able to work these things out. So when at the time when UP and you know, WEPCO have good relations, UP says, well, we could charge them a higher price, but not a big deal, you know, we'll let it go, we won't bother. Then, of course, they have a falling out later. They decide to enforce their rights. But I think the no-waiver clause is designed precisely to allow a, you know, amicable relationship to develop without each party feeling that the slightest occasion on which it could, you know, hurt the other party on the basis of some contractual right, it forbears.
The non-waiver provision applies to failures to insist upon performance, not the right to waive your own obligation to perform. These are sophisticated parties.
Waive your own obligation? I don't understand that. Of course, you can waive your own obligation, but you don't want your failure to enforce your rights to the hilt to be taken as a waiver, because that means you have to jump at the first opportunity and say, you owe me this extra charge, even if you're willing to forgive it because you don't think it's such a big deal and you want to have a friendly relationship.
They had an obligation to provide prompt notice of a force majeure event so that WEPCO could take action.
So that you could pay $7 million more. You'd have loved that.
We might have been able to obtain coal supply arrangements where we would have actually benefited.
Well, you have no evidence of that, of course. Absolutely none. You have no evidence of any reliance loss. It's just words. Right? Zero evidence.
We have the testimony of one witness that he believed the marketplace would have been
different. That's completely inadequate. Right? You didn't go out and see what were the avail at the time of the when the iron pellets ceased moving. What were the actual market opportunities for WEPCO? You didn't present evidence of that.
That's correct, Your Honor. A ruling that there is no prompt notice requirement, however, writes the notice requirement out of the contract. It would also write the abatement provision out of the contract. The UP made absolutely no effort to abate the condition.
You're all wet. Look, suppose they said 2 years after the iron pellets have disappeared, oh, by the way, you owe us another $7 million. Well, that's where the prompt notice comes in. They can't do that. They can't retroactively whack you for right. They can't do that. The notice is when they tell you, yes, you know, after the 2 years, we're going to charge you the extra money because we don't have the iron pellets. That's when they have to give you notice. They did give you notice. They gave you notice as soon as they decided to enforce this clause.
The notice is supposed to be about the triggering event, not the effect of the event. In any event, even if you accept that the notice was timely, they presented absolutely no evidence of any effort to abate the force majeure condition, which is another obligation, which is another condition precedent to claim an effective force majeure.
What are they supposed to do? Buy the Geneva Steel Company and restore its production?
They have other options.
When Geneva has decided to liquidate because there's no more opportunities for them?
There are other bulk commodities that could have been explored as potential substitutes for this backhaul. When asked at a deposition, their marketing executive, his response to what he did to abate the condition was, why would I? Nothing. That does not satisfy the condition that you make a reasonable effort to abate the force majeure event that you're claiming. The district court... Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't it a bit irrationally literal to require Union Pacific to provide evidence that its contract with Geneva had been terminated when it's clear Geneva went belly up, closed its doors, ceased all operations? I mean...
It was clear in November 2001, and WEPCO had a reasonable basis to rely on their inaction because they applied that rate for 2.5 years.
So is it your position that Union Pacific should have said in 2001, look, Geneva Steel is going out of business. We won't be altering our rates now. But But this is a force majeure event, and we reserve the right to alter our rates at any time. Is that your position?
It would have been very simple for a sophisticated railroad like the Union Pacific Railroad to do that. Instead,
But then again, everybody knew this outfit was in bankruptcy when you guys entered into this contract, right?
That's correct, and that goes to another point. The backhaul rate was being applied even though there was no iron ore being reloaded in the first place. WEBCO relied on the UP's continued application for 2.5 years. A sophisticated railroad marketing department voluntarily relinquished $7 million.
Right.
And they did that, we believe, knowingly.
During that period of time?
Excuse me?
Were there any shipments during that period of time?
There were no iron ore shipments.
Period.
And there was, again, no effort.
Again, wasn't that maybe a conservative, but a prudent interpretation on the part of the of Union Pacific? After all, when you entered into the contract, everybody knew there was a bankruptcy in the picture already. Union Pacific simply said, look, we're not going to declare force majeure until there is no hope for this thing.
The point of no hope, by their own admission in their interrogatories and in the testimony of their witnesses and the force majeure letter they sent, was November 2001. That's the event impacting iron ore reloading that they are now trying to claim as their force majeure event. As to the abatement requirement, the district court determined the abatement requirement doesn't apply to the backhaul force majeure claim. There's absolutely no basis in the contract to reach that conclusion. Article 11A is the general force majeure provision. It lays out basic force majeure conditions, whether...
Where's the text of that in your brief?
The language appears in the appendix at pages 37 to 39. And Article 11A lays out the very basic force majeure, general force majeure conditions and terms. B and C deal with specific force majeure events, including C, which is the backhaul event. And that provision begins by stating, in the case of backhaul movements to KCBX, which is the terminal, the parties also understand and acknowledge. And then it goes on to explain that condition.
Look. The contract reads that an event impacting iron ore reloading to Geneva constitutes an event of force majeure. Well, that sounds like a per se definition to me at any rate. And I read your brief to say that Union Pacific has to prove that there was some sort of impact on its operations in order to declare an event of force majeure. Is that your position? And is it what appears at 37 to 39 in the appendix, is that the provision of the contract that you think imposes that obligation?
Article 11A lists, in order for any force majeure to be effective, you have to show that it delays or prevents performance. Clearly here, the termination of the backhaul did not delay or prevent their performance. Article D requires prompt notice. Article E of that section says that you have to make reasonable efforts to eliminate or abate the force majeure condition. There's absolutely...
That would be fine if it was something like there was some strike or something like that that was blocking them from shipping the iron pellets, and they could have gotten around it. They could have hired a substitute carrier or something of that sort. But it can't be that they're required to do some elaborate investigation of all possible backhaul opportunities going west. And
they have some obligation, Your Honor. They made no effort. And we believe this is, again, a sophisticated railroad. What really happened, not unlike the Carbon County case.
What is your evidence that if they had, they would have found something?
It's not our burden to show that they had those marketing opportunities. We don't control the Union Pacific's marketing.
No damages if, in fact, they couldn't have feasibly found something else to ship to Utah from Wisconsin.
We do have damage. We paid the higher rate for the term from...
No. You wouldn't have any damages if there weren't any possibility for some other backhaul shipments by UP to substitute.
If there weren't any, we would have paid the higher rate and we would be stuck with that higher rate. Yes. That's correct.
Well, you should have put in some evidence that they really had an opportunity to.
They have the burden of proof to show that they made an effort to abate. The evidence we put in was that their chief marketing officer said, why would I?
Let me ask another question before you sit. I didn't understand. You seem to have, in another part of your case, you have some argument that UP failed to furnish enough rail cars.
That's correct.
I don't understand that. You have your own rail cars.
The way this contract works, there were rates for both movements in shipper rail cars and in railroad rail cars. It's commonplace in contracts to have rates set on both those terms. The economics work that when the railroad provides the rail cars, you pay a higher rate than you would if you ship them in your own cars. We agreed with Union Pacific here. Union Pacific agreed that they would provide the railroad cars, the rail cars, for this backhaul move. They also had full knowledge of the tonnage that was being shipped. We provided declared tonnages. We provided monthly shipping schedules. And they understood what their delivery obligation was pursuant to those notifications. And it's our position that when you read those provisions together with the express good faith obligation to make...
Why don't you furnish your own cars?
We have the option under the agreement to do either.
But it's cheaper if you furnish your own cars.
Not necessarily. It's less for the transportation, but you pay for the asset. So it's a matter of economics. It's the way it balances out.
What's the evidence you actually incurred a loss as a result of this? Did you put in any evidence?
We put in evidence that we suffered damages, yes.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Pergolese. Mr. Uredsky?
May it please the Court, James Uredsky for Union Pacific. The argument seems to change from brief to brief. What was presented in the summary judgment, what was presented in the appellant's brief, and what was presented in the reply brief seems to be trying to hit a moving target. But what the district court had was the contract, which is plain on its face, although it is a complex and lengthy contract. But with respect to the issues we're here today about, these are provisions that simply WEPCO doesn't like. And they like to try to figure out how they can get around the language of the contract. And then you have the record. And in the record, at the summary judgment at the district court level, their thrust was targeting getting out of the contract. Their claim was the contract was ambiguous. They presented evidence of extrinsic nature to show the course and performance of the backhaul and the backhaul rate. The district court clearly in their order, after considering everything, determined that the contract was clear, that was not ambiguous, and the court went on to interpret the contract and the connection between the backhaul rate, and the very clear indication that there was an event of force majeure.
Mr. Perlisi's argument that you didn't try to find a substitute for the iron pellets?
Well, the abatement issue is certainly, I don't want to say ridiculous, but there was no other provider of steel in the U.S. in that particular era of our country's history west of the Mississippi, and that was known, and that was in the record, at least in our summary judgment.
Why did it have to be steel as opposed to any other bulk commodity?
Well, with respect to the contract and the genesis of the contract, the movement and the transportation had to be with respect to the iron ore pellets. That was clearly the intent of the contract. That's clearly what everybody negotiated. That was, in fact, what they thought they would be able to make compatible with respect to cleaning the cars of the iron ore pellets and then loading the coal. But as the court can see, the force majeure event is the repositioning of the cars to load the iron ore.
Let me just get this completely clear. Notwithstanding the fact that the contract did not require it, I was curious, as are my brothers, whether Union Pacific could have backhauled a material other than iron ore, or do the rail cars have to carry only certain compatible materials?
With respect to this move and these uncovered hopper cars, the process in place that made this marketable was the iron ore pellets, the location of the iron ore to be loaded in Minnesota, the transportation of that to Utah, and the cleansing of the cars. For example, you couldn't do it with sawdust, you couldn't do it with wood products, you couldn't do it with respect to other items because it would have required a different type of a car. But the compatibility between the iron ore movement, the cleansing process, and then the loading of the coal and the transport of that made it marketable and commercially suitable.
But following up on Judge Ripple's question, does the abatement clause actually mention pellets?
No, the abatement clause just is a process of the contract that talks about what would be required in with respect to a typical force majeure. Let's say a landslide, a rock slide, a snowstorm. It'd have to be cleaned up.
So your problem is you've got a specific force majeure clause and a general abatement clause.
Exactly.
And with your argument is we need to read them together, is that right?
Argument is that the force majeure provision in regards to this particular event, the cessation of the iron ore movement, is a peculiar event that there is no abatement, even if you read that into the...
Why didn't the parties write a specific abatement clause that was responsive to the specific force majeure clause? I mean, I think that's what's causing this whole problem.
Right. I think with respect to that, again, it was the uniqueness of the iron ore and the abatement being with respect to what would more typically be a force majeure kind of a situation.
Somebody cut and pasted the abatement clause.
Most likely.
Is what happened.
And factually.
It's a practical matter, and they shouldn't have done that.
Right.
You're saying someone who knew the industry would know that they weren't required to figure out where they could carry eggs, you know, from Minnesota to Utah and the iron.
Exactly. And with respect to the ambiguity issue, that was never appealed. That's not in their brief. They seem to have abandoned the contract interpretation. They never contested at the district court the issue of whether or not there was an event of force majeure. It's only after the ruling of the court on the appeal side that they raise the whether or not there was an event of force majeure and claim for the first time, well, you could have prevented this or it could have been handled in a different way. And certainly that was something that was not contested and not really addressed on appeal with respect to the ambiguity issue. With respect to the question the court had on the illogic nature of their claim with respect to their damages, but what they were saying is that we should have notified them immediately at some point, even though it's undisputed that up until February of 2004, Geneva Steel had not necessarily been crated away. Now, what happened with respect to their claim, again, they received a $7 million windfall. I mean, it just defies logic. And then they try to backdoor in, and for the first time really on appeal, this, even though they claim there was detrimental reliance, in their reply brief, I believe at page 12, they say for the first time they could have gotten lower rates on coal. There's no evidence at all in the record about that. In fact, they try to push off this witness that they brought in as a 30B6 witness, and we asked him, what harm did you suffer as a result of this period of time that you claim we should have notified you, and when we did? And he said that would be speculative. Now, this is a company that burns coal commercially. If they had any evidence that they could have gotten cheaper coal anywhere else, that evidence would have been brought forward. Instead, in their briefs, they say this witness, you know, was kind of, it had been a long time. He really, you know, was kind of unclear on this. And but this was the person who, on 30B6, the corporate representative came in. There's no evidence in a record at all of any detriment that they suffered at all. So what they're saying is that had we declared this force majeure earlier, they would have been out an additional $7 million, and as the court points out, they're going to give it back. That's not part of their deal. With respect to the issue that the court raised on the rail cars, again, the contract is clear. The contract has several options. In one of the paragraphs, there's a service commitment where if they took the service commitment, used their own rail cars, there would be liquidated damages as a result of not delivering the coal that they ordered. They want to twist that somehow and turn that into what they did take. And they started out this case saying, you had a duty to deliver the nominated tonnage. There was a shortfall. You owe us. That's what they started out. Now they've shifted and they're saying, well, you really had a good faith, reasonable effort duty to get more rail cars to deliver the nominated tonnage. And Judge Randa wouldn't go down that road because the contract that he had and all the contract that he had and the record didn't allow that.
So
clearly,
Wisconsin Electric argues that it didn't ask Judge Randa for a finding of fact that UP breached its duty of good faith, only for a decision on whether UP had a duty of good faith. Are you agreeing with that description?
What I believe the procedure was in the process in the district court was that we clearly, on page 22 of our summary judgment pleading, said that WEPCO could not present any evidence whatsoever that UP did not proceed in good faith. And they didn't present any evidence. They didn't even respond in their summary judgment papers to that particular throwing down the gauntlet, the particular, as Judge Randa said, put up or shut up. And incredibly, in their first appeal brief, and I believe it's on page 42, they admit that they did not put any evidence in on the issue of whether or not UP breached its duty of good faith. In fact, they say, WEPCO did not present any specific evidence that UP breached its good faith obligation because UP did not assert in its motion or supporting brief that it complied with that obligation. Then in their reply on page 14, they say there was no need for WEPCO to introduce evidence demonstrating the existence of a factual dispute. Now, Logan requires them, if they don't believe we've thrown down the gauntlet, and there's no way, if you read page 22 of our summary judgment papers, there's no way to interpret that we didn't throw down the gauntlet, and they admit in their pleadings that they didn't present any evidence. And so Judge Randa, the district court, can do one of two things. He can interpret the contract and say, you know, you had a duty to deliver all the nominated tonnage, but I don't see that in the contract, and it's not in the contract. And the second thing he would say is, well, what facts are there to show that the Union Pacific didn't act in good faith? And clearly there were none, and so Judge Randa had no other option other than to enter the decision that he did. And the decision that he entered was clearly based on his interpretation of the contract and the record as it existed.
But could you just take a minute to explain? I have difficulty understanding this this claim about the good faith. Now, are they saying that UP, you didn't have a contractual obligation to ship more than you shipped, but that you had a good faith obligation to see whether there might be some way in which you could ship more? Is that what they're arguing, or am I?
There's
some other argument.
They're taking Roman numeral 6 and B, and they're saying that the parties, here's what the contract says about good faith, and I'll just read it. The parties agree to make good faith, reasonable efforts to meet the monthly shipping schedule and to inform each other of any changes to the monthly shipping schedule. What they're saying is that really means that the Union Pacific has a duty under this provision to use enough rail cars to bring us all the coal we want.
But the agreement didn't contain any specific amount of tonnage that Union Pacific had to transport?
Absolutely not. And we delivered 85% of those 3 years that they complain of, and yet there was no... 84%.
So their argument, though, is you found more profitable shippers, and you switched cars to them. Is that what they argue?
Their argument evolves, Your Honor, but the first time they raise it is in a footnote in their appellate brief, and in the appellate brief they refer to an affidavit of a William Crowder, or of an expert report that's not sworn. There's no specific compliance to Rule 56 about those bits and pieces of record that may have been made that weren't. But only in the reply brief do they then come with their last four pages of facts, supposedly, that we weren't able to respond to, number one. And number two, they don't point to a monthly shipping schedule to show the court this is what we mean. So you're left with nothing but speculation and argument and words, nothing on the record on either of these two issues. And we would ask the court to affirm the decision of the district court.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Uresky. So, Mr. Pergolesi, we'll give you a minute since we asked a lot of questions.
Thank you. Just a couple of very quick points. We did indeed claim that the event was not effective, was not valid, because they failed to comply with the procedural requirements, and that is in our brief at pages 18 to 20. They are also wrong that we did not make the delayed or prevent point. We made those points as well, and the abatement point. The abatement point, there are other commodities. They put no evidence in that iron ore was the only commodity that could have moved. They put no evidence in that there were no other commodities such as soda ash, maybe other coal.
But when it says abate the force majeure event, it's not clear to me that that means a substitute performance. That is, the event was the failure of Geneva Steel to take the iron pellets. Now, if there is something that UP could have done to prevent that, if Geneva had come to them and said, "Look, you know, we're going to have to close down unless you give us $100," right? We're at our last. We need $100. And then UP says no because we're happy to see you close because we'll charge a higher rate to WEPCO. But it's nothing like that. They couldn't do anything to prevent Geneva from terminating its business. And what it seems to me it would make the abatement clause, well, I think contrary to its language also, make it completely open-ended if they not only have to make an abatement effort, that is, try to keep the Geneva alive, if could, you actually have to restructure their business so that they have Western shipments of some other bulk commodity.
Well, Your Honor, we believe they should have at least explored those options. On good faith, if I may, we did put in evidence, and it's in the appendix, that at the same time they were cutting our deliveries back to 84%, their overall Colorado volumes were up 13.2%. They don't dispute that. They also admit that some of those new movements were at higher transportation rates. They don't dispute that. They don't dispute that they received annual declarations. They don't dispute that they received monthly shipping schedules. They don't dispute that they didn't deliver.
Why is it bad faith for them? They don't have a fixed obligation to you. They have a bunch of other people, shippers, who want their stuff shipped. Why is it bad faith for them to satisfy some of those demands and go down to the 84%? Why is that
absolutely not good faith to enter into new agreements after you have one that says you will make a good faith, reasonable effort to deliver monthly shipping schedules?
A good faith, reasonable effort might be 84% because you have other customers. What's wrong with that?
They took those customers on knowing they had that commitment.
How would a judge or a jury ever figure out, should have been 84%, should have been 90%? What's your view? Should have been 100%?
My view is, consistent with Carbon County and NIPSCO Coal, NIPSCO versus Carbon County Coal, that you can't use economics to create a force and then hide behind.
So are you saying that they had to do 100%?
I'm saying they had to make a good faith, reasonable effort.
Force majeure with a good faith. I mean, forget that.
Because that's the event that triggered them.
Forget force majeure. What is the good faith obligation? What was the good faith obligation of Union Pacific? That it couldn't ship any coal for anybody else until it got to 100%? Is that your view?
No, our view is that knowing the commitment they had to WEPCO, knowing that they had agreed otherwise to provide rail cars, as Judge Randa found, knowing that our monthly shipping schedules exceeded the minimum annual volume.
You're not answering my question. What percentage of WEPCO's demand would they have to satisfy to be guiltless of bad faith?
I think that would be a fact issue for the juror.
Answer my question.
I think it would be upwards of 90%, certainly. And
where do you get that idea from?
Because they are increasing their overall volumes and revenues. They're taking advantage of a favorable transportation market. They manage the resources, the track, the crews, the locomotives.
So why don't you say 100%? Why are you...
I said upwards of 90. Because it becomes an issue at some point.
It's
you have to draw a line.
It's so fuzzy.
Well, that may be, Your Honor, but they did have an obligation.
Did you present evidence of this in the summary judgment proceeding?
We did present evidence. We are constrained somewhat by the fact that we have a protective order that limits who can see the evidence we obtained from the Union Pacific Railroad. Only outside consultants could look at their traffic data, their revenue data, and their arrangements with the other shippers.
Did they do that?
They did, and we put in...
evidence?
It is in evidence.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Uredsky, and Mr. Perdolici.